Alrighty. Well, my name is Lisa. I'm an alcoholic.
Lisa.
And for the first time ever, I came prepared because I am nervous. Part of that has to do with the format of what I'm to speak on. And what I really appreciate is the verbiage, the cross-section of what's represented here. I am not the majority of what we design as our higher power. I represent the minority. But I did see this as an opportunity that there might be someone out there that's like me, and they can say, I'm like that too. So that's why you see me here today. With that being said, I'll go ahead and introduce myself like we normally do. With that being said, I picked up a white chip 5 months ago. I cannot tell you the last time I drank. I picked up my white chip because I decided I actually believed I had hope in staying sober the next day. There was a period of sobriety before that, but from one day to the next, I couldn't have told you whether I could have stayed sober. So that white chip was a testament to the fact that, oh my gosh, I might actually be able to stay sober tomorrow. And so far, that's happened for 5 months in a row. I have a sponsor. She happens to know my sponsor, and she's even here to support me. I have a support network that is wider than I thought that it was. So there are a few people who agreed to join me today, and then a few people who surprised me as well. And that's kind of the awesome thing about AA, isn't it? Even when we don't realize that there's people out there who support us. So with that being said, let's talk about what it was like. Back when I was a wee little bairn. So I grew up in an affluent community. And my family has been there for so long that we have lakes and streets and everything named after us. So our appearances were perfect all the time. If you can guess, when you opened up the cupboards, it did not look that way. I definitely grew up in a dysfunctional family home. There is some substance abuse within the family. I didn't know that for years. I didn't know that for the first 10 years of my alcoholism, because appearances meant everything, and that included within my family. As my parents have also healed, they've started to tell me about other people in my family, and it was wonderful because I didn't feel so alone, and that felt really good. Within the community, my role within the dysfunctional family unit was the family hero. So I have an older brother that's mentally handicapped, and a younger brother that I worked really hard to protect. So my role was the hero. What did that mean? Straight A's all the time. I had to be in the newspaper for all of my sports. I wasn't allowed to not be in sports. I remember one time I asked my parents if I could go hang out with friends. And my dad said, well, what are you going to be doing? And I was like, just hanging out. No, you're not allowed to hang out. And that was true. I had to produce all the time. And if I wasn't producing, I was failing. That is important because that has created a lens for my entire life. I was taught if you didn't throw up at the end of a race, if you didn't foul out it by the end of the game, you weren't trying hard enough. And I did that with absolutely everything in my life. I learned, someone had told me, it was a counselor, the difference between someone from a dysfunctional family home and someone from a healthy home, you know, they're in high school and they're going to parties and they try alcohol or they try pot or they try something for the first time. Both of them are like, ooh, that was fun, right? Then you have the person from the healthy home. The next day they're like, I have a hangover and this sucks, right? The person from the dysfunctional family home, I have a hangover and this feels the exact same with every day of my life. So the only thing we remember is, man, that was fun. I can't wait to do it again. Am I saying that that's what makes me an alcoholic? Absolutely not. What it did afford me was the opportunity to say, I want to figure out if I'm an alcoholic a whole bunch, even though I didn't know that that's the research that I was doing. So I did some dabbling when I was a teenager, and I can look back at my group of friends. Some of them have perfect lives. You know, when you look on the outside, and I'm sure they're probably pretty imperfect, but they don't struggle with the disease. Some of them have died from the disease. Some of them are like me and are in a program all of us drank the same way when we were in high school. And that's another data point for me that this really is a disease. It wasn't about like when we started drinking, why we were drinking, like how did we get triggered, et cetera. So when I was 17, I got hit by a semi with a good friend of mine. She was paralyzed from the waist down. As you can see, I was not. But my life completely changed that day. So I went from this person that's really struggling at home, wanting to tell people about the stuff that's going on at home, but no one's going to believe me because my family name is so predominant within the community, to now I can't earn the love and praise anymore because I can't physically do it, which meant I didn't have love and praise anymore, and that included for my parents. With that, I really struggled with knowing that I'm not paralyzed and my friend is. So what I decided to do was homeschool so that I could take care of my friend. So my junior year of high school, I lost my scholarship for basketball going to Purdue. That sucked. Cried about that. Transferred over to homeschooling, took care of my friend for a significant period of time. That also gave me a whole lot of time to be around the very people that I wanted love from so much. And I wasn't producing for them anymore. And so I was seeing a significantly less amount of that love that I really craved. So I started looking for it elsewhere. And what I found was gangs. I tell you what, they will readily accept you right away. Who cares what you do? You don't have to produce for me. That is what they're projecting to you. And I love the fact that I didn't have to do anything for these people to like me. And you know what else I liked? They didn't hide. Can I cuss in here? They didn't hide. Shoot. Okay. Yes, they were not the best people, but they showed that they weren't the best people. And there was something about that honesty and authenticity that drew me in. And I will tell you to this day, that is the number one way to draw me in. Let me make sure it's crystal clear, not to act like shoot, right? The authenticity is what I really appreciate. However, after I experienced some time with them, that's really all there is to it, right? They're doing a lot of shady stuff with a lot of shady people. And when it gets down to it, all they do really care about is what you're doing for them. That's all they really care about. And that bothered me a lot. As my alcoholism progressed, that's exactly who I turned out to be. The very thing that hurt my heart so much, the person who said, if you don't produce for me, I have no need for you. That's who I was. I embodied the very thing that caused so much pain to me. Cutting, baffling, and powerful, right? Like, when you look at Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, when I started seeing Mr. Hyde and like knowing that that's who I was becoming, I hadn't even faced any legal consequences yet or anything of that nature, but just knowing that I started personifying the very thing that had torn me down as a human being, that was something that was very difficult for me to face. What I had not yet answered was, do I drink because I'm an alcoholic? I'm sure you all could probably assume that being around that societal nature, I was exposed to some things. Not very positive things. I've been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. I've probably earned it. So with that being said, I very much had the mentality, yeah, I drink too much. If you have experienced what I've experienced, you drink too. One of the biggest things I can't stand is when I hear people say, everyone's been through stuff. If you've experienced what I have experienced, you would never say that. And that's how I felt, right? this is the reason why I'm drinking. I'm drinking because I have these huge feelings over these things that have happened, and that's why I'm drinking. Until I drank, even though that wasn't the case. So I worked with therapists. I got help with a psychiatrist. I'm on antidepressant medication. Still drinking. Now it's anxiety. Now it's this. Now it's that. Pretty much any extreme emotion. So I'm still able to say this is an external coping mechanism. And that is my issue. And I can connect with others that this is an external coping mechanism and that's their issue. And that's really all I kept thinking was, I don't necessarily think that I'm an alcoholic. If I can just fix the people I'm around, if I can just fix my environment, that's really the issue. The issue isn't me at all. I'm sure nobody has ever been through this thought process whatsoever. If I just fix my environment, if I just fix everything around me, if I just convince you that I'm okay, then I'll be okay. Come to find out, that doesn't work either. So the first meeting I ever went to, I learned about the term YET, the acronym you're eligible to. And have y'all ever heard the phrase, like, I'm going to place this on your heart? Like, if somebody's saying something to you, I'm going to place this on your heart. And someone asked me one time, do you know why people say that? Like, no, not really. It's their way of saying, like, you might not believe me, but you really need to hear this right now. You know? Yes. When your heart breaks enough, it'll fall in. Yets fell in. The yets fell in. And my first meeting, it was like a bunch of biker dudes who had been through some serious stuff. And I thought I had been through some serious stuff. And they made me feel like an angel. Which meant that I didn't belong there. So I shall continue down my path. But the cool thing was I heard their stories, right? And I heard, like, oh man, I did this when I was drunk. Oh man, I did that when I was drunk. I didn't connect with any of them until I started connecting with them. And each time it ruined drinking for me, right? Because it was like, oh crap, this is happening. I might be an alcoholic too. Oh crap, I'm feeling that way. I might be an alcoholic too. It kind of reminds me of Jeff Foxworthy. You know how he's like, you might be a redneck. And that you look at my life and I think about those yets and it's like, well, if you wake up in a stranger shed and you're not quite sure if the stranger or yourself put you in there, you might be an alcoholic. Like, those are the types of yets that I was researching. And, you know, and then I could, and now I'm like, okay, I drink because I'm an alcoholic. And now I have 20/20 vision. So let's look back all the way back to high school. Because this is like late 20s. So at first I was like, yeah, but I became an alcoholic when I'm 20, right? If you are 14 years old and the school starts breathalyzing everybody at the school dances because of you, you might be an alcoholic, right? Like, that's the reality of the situation. So it's very clear to me. I drink because I'm an alcoholic. There was one TV show I watched one time. She had this glass of wine, right? She goes, and I laughed at her. It doesn't hit you that fast. They don't even know what it's like. Until one time, I was deep in my cups for weeks, probably even months. And I woke up, I was shaking, I was feeling terrible. And I poured a cup of gin in my child's kitty cup because it was bigger than a shot glass and it could be hidden. And that cup of gin, I could smell it. And I started shaking even more because my body knew it was coming. And I drank it. Did I feel it? No. What did I do? I had faith in that. And at that moment, that was my higher power. And it created a lot of solutions for me until it didn't. And I hear that a lot. So I want to clarify. What I don't mean by that is yeah, it still felt good, but I had all of these consequences. I went through that phase too, right? Like I think about like back with like Ricky Lake TV shows, you know, they had the clap-a-meter where it's like green and then yellow and then red. Like I did the green where I was like binge drinking, right? Then I did the yellow, and then I got into the red where it was like even when I drank, even during the process of drinking, it no longer solved anything for me. It didn't deaden any of the emotions that I was looking for. In fact, the negative consequences came from the drinking itself, not from a side effect of the drinking. So yes, was I embarrassing myself and texting people that I shouldn't at 2 a.m. and not making sense? Totally, right? But like after the first drink, was I throwing up and not even feeling any effects whatsoever? Yes. Was I telling myself how much I don't enjoy this while I'm watching my hand bringing another cup to my face? Yes. And I think that that's where that definition of powerlessness comes from, right? I think about authority figures in my life, coaches, teachers, or bosses, right? They tell me to do something and I'm going to do it. And when my alcoholism is very strong, it is an authority figure inside of my mind. And it tells me to do something. And it's like my body says, okay, it is my job to do this. And I am a passenger watching it doing it. Because my healthy side of me, my sobriety is so weak that it's not capable of making a choice, it's not capable of even making a movement. So I would say that that's powerless. The next one is unmanageability. One of the definitions of unmanageability is if other people manage your life. I do not believe that orange is the new black, and I have found out, right? So I've absolutely had my life managed where I'm told when I can eat breakfast, when I can eat lunch, when I can eat dinner. And I tell them, hey, I'm allergic to the ingredients that's in that food. And they said, I don't care, continue to eat it. I would say that is probably a pretty good level of unmanageability, among other things. So I still continued with a facade. That has been what I've known my whole life. As a child, it's still in the back of my head today. I'm still looking at you today, fighting that facade. But another woman in a meeting, she mentioned the phrase rigorously honest. And she said, I was sitting there in a meeting, and I was all dressed up in this meeting. And I realized that all it was doing was convincing everyone else I was fine instead of being honest with you when I wasn't. At said meeting, I was in a pencil skirt, button-down shirt, high heels, and made sure to drive my Mercedes in. Did I mention that I don't have a driver's license nor a car anymore? I would like to be very vulnerable with that in this moment. Because today I don't want to convince you that I'm fine. Because if there's aspects where I'm not fine, if I tell you about that, that's my opportunity to grow. And isn't that awesome? If I don't tell you about that, then I'm going to stay right where I am. And that is not the point of us being here. Now we get to the good part, the power greater than ourselves and how it can restore us to insanity. Or sanity. Good catch. I think that may have been a Freudian slip. So as I was saying, my secrets keep me sick. They really do. And it ha doesn't have to just be about drinking, right? If I can't find people that I feel safe to be vulnerable with, I will stay sick. I have tested it. It is true for this alcoholic. The whole fake it till you make it thing. It did not work for me, right? Like, I couldn't try to be something and try to convince myself of it. I tried so hard. I tried so hard. I was raised in a specific religious belief, and I saw other people that, like, it worked so well for them and they were so fulfilled. And I tried desperately to feel the way that they felt. and it never worked for me. I couldn't get it. Whatever they had, I couldn't find it. Did I have the facade that I had it? Did I speak the same words they were speaking? Yes. Yes, I did. So instead, what I decided to do was truly ask myself, what do you? And I had to find that out because I'd never asked that of myself ever in my whole life. So what I did is I started looking up, well, what are all the other things that people may believe? I even looked up like cults. Like, did you know the Oneida community? Oneida, the silverware? Like, I think I have Oneida silverware. That was a cult. And I researched them because who say they're wrong, right? But I went ahead and looked up some stuff. And what I realized is I don't have to have categorical thinking, right? I don't have to say, oh, this one app. Is true, and I have to believe that it's true. That's the case for this alcoholic. But are there some things that I can really relate to, and does it work for me? Those were the two things. Does it relate? Does it make sense? Does it work? And yes, I found something that relates, makes sense, and works. And so what that meant for me was basically a wave realizing it's the ocean. So here I am, I'm this wave, I'm looking around at all the other waves. Sometimes I'm a big wave, sometimes I'm a little wave. When I'm a little wave, I don't like that wave is bigger than me, you know? And I'm rolling, I'm crashing. And I gather up all my energy again and try to do it, and I'm crashing. And I'm gathering, and I'm doing this all by myself. And I'm not all by myself. I am the whole ocean. I was surprised today to walk in, and not only do I have a group of ladies who went to dinner with me, but I have people from another group that I didn't even know knew I was speaking today. My ocean is more vast than I even thought. That is how big my higher power is. That is how vast it is. And that is how personal it is to me too. I'm not gonna cry. I have makeup on. So what does that mean applicably in life? So there's a psychological term, it's called Johari's window. So when you look at a window, there's four panes. One pane, it's all the stuff I know about me that none of the rest of you get to know about me, okay? Then there's a pane that all of you know about me and I don't know, it's this stuff, okay? Then there's this pane that we all know about. And then there's this pane that none of us know about yet. Am I willing to admit that there's more than just this pain? Am I willing to be open-minded that I can learn from this pain? Am I willing to consider that if enough people from this pain, if I hear the feedback from three or more people, even if I don't like hearing it, if three of you come up to me after the meeting and tell me I'm a pink elephant, I need to consider that I may be a pink elephant. Or there was acid in the coffee. It's one of the two. That's part of it. Now, how did I make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him? I do that through meditation and mindfulness. I definitely try to keep an open mind as much as possible. And I'm also a neutral observer of self. So like I said, even if I don't like to hear something, and I may not have the best thoughts in the moment, I try not to say those thoughts, and I will say thank you for the feedback, or you may be right. And when I have a little less emotion, I try to sit and think about the things that have been said to me. Then I'm a neutral observer of self. So very often when I'm thinking, I think that's who I am, right? But like, has anybody ever argued with yourself in your head? Right? How can both of those be me? Or is it possible that none of my thoughts are me? And if that's possible, can I just step back and watch all of them? And if that's possible, that means I don't have to judge any of them. And I don't even have to be offended if they're right or wrong. So what does that mean? I can have a compulsion to drink because I'm an alcoholic, and it not mean that I'm a bad person. So I can call my sponsor and, hey, sponsor, I was watching a comedian, and for some reason, the comedian's voice told my, this is a real story, by the way, just in case anybody wants to know. The comedian's voice told my brain that it needed to drink. And I can tell my sponsor that without thinking that I'm a bad person. And my sponsor, rightfully so, says, we're going to a meeting. And I can go in that said meeting. And because I've developed rapport and I'm in my ocean, I can tell those people the exact same thing. And that doesn't mean that I'm a bad person, because I don't have to identify with that thought. Now, step four. Is anybody else grumpy when you did step four? Like, I was so grumpy, like, the entire time. My patience was like this small. And the best advice that I ever received for step four was like, just do it like there's no fist up, right? Because that was the biggest thing for me, was like, it's one thing to like write it down, and it was a lot to look at the words. Like, this happened. I did this. What was bigger? Someone else needs to know that this happened. Someone else. So if I did my 4-step and I just pretended there was no fist step, all of a sudden that got a little bit easier. But then we did get to the fifth step. That was rough. But once again, I don't know if you noticed, there's a very common thread, but my eureka moments have never come from within here. My first thought tends to be wrong, but I get such good advice, and I get little nuggets. I consider them seeds, and I can toss away those seeds, or I can plant them, and I can water them. And I can make sure that they grow beautifully within my mind. And one of those seeds was, for the FISTA, if there's a word in the English language, someone else has done it. Well, so that means that, like, even though it's bad, I'm not the only one who's done the bad thing. So that made it a little bit easier for me. But just that phrase alone, what that meant was acceptance, right? Whatever you're about to tell me, I'm letting you know that this is a safe place. And I think that's one of the most important aspects of these rooms. And I think that I just need to be super honest that I don't always see it. I don't always see us creating safe spaces for each other. Because damn, we're human, including me, you know. So when it does, and I can even feel it, right? It feels like a soft pillow, like a blanket that you can snuggle up in. Those soft spaces make my walk in sobriety just a little bit lighter. And those are the people that I want to stick with. When I got to my 6-step, this most recent time, because I've been through my steps a couple of times, I think this is the most transformative 6-step I've ever done. And the reason why I say that, you know, that white chip I told you I picked up 5 months ago, certainly not the first white chip I've ever picked up. I was coming up on 3 years when I decided to go do some more investigating before that white chip. During the period before that investigation, I realized what I learn in AA, my defective thought process can take something beneficial and make it defective. and I did not. So one of the things I learned was acceptance. That doesn't have to mean allowance. I struggle with codependency. So acceptance plus codependency equals allowance to the nth degree, AKA, no matter what you do to me, if you're doing it to me, there must be something wrong with me. Are you abusing me? Are you gaslighting me? Are you doing things that are harmful to me? Well, there must be something wrong with me. I used something I learned and I did it effectively. So this time around with the sixth step, it was super duper important to me that I really focused on these character defects. So some of the things that I needed to make sure that I did, I noticed that my four step showed me how I developed those. Because those defects are there because they did something for me. There was a reason why I needed them. So I needed to figure out why I needed them. And I know the seventh step is coming up soon. Now I need to understand that it's no longer needed. Ooh, that's a tough one. Ooh, that's a tough one. I'm sure I'm the only person in this room who has ever struggled with trust issues, but even though things are going great right now, that doesn't mean that they'll go great next week. So if I completely get rid of my armor and I can't pick it up at a moment's notice when I need it, do you realize how vulnerable you're making me? And you're telling me that's what I should do? Yes. Okay. So then I worked my seventh step with my sponsor. And we talked a lot about awareness. And for like months, I started noticing how that defect would, that happened like last week, actually, now that I'm thinking about it. I was aware of how my defect would come in. And it's like, okay, this is a perfect example, Lisa. Like, why are you still barking in this way when you don't need to anymore? It was also a really cool example of how some of them in this process, even though I drank again, have been shed, right? So there's someone in this meeting who got to meet me when I was in jail and has seen big, bad Lisa. Okay, the intimidating Lisa. That Lisa has a different walk, okay? Like, she, the people who know me today, when I tell them that that's part of my character defects that sit ready and wait, they don't believe me. They're like, what are you talking about? I can't even imagine that person. And I'm looking in this group of people and I'm like, there's somebody who can. And it's, so it's pretty cool to know, like, just because I drank doesn't mean that everything that I learned in AA was thrown away. It was a data set. And today I have hope that just as I'm sober today, I can be sober tomorrow. But I, today, my pride doesn't rest on it like a day that it did. Each day I get to learn from the people in my surroundings and I can acknowledge where I no longer have to act defectively. I can also acknowledge when I do act defectively and I can receive feedback from when I act defectively. For the most part, can we just acknowledge that I'm human? Am I allowed to be human? Okay. Okay, so when the first time I made the list of all the people I had harmed, I was like, right, but they deserved it though. Like, like really the only reason why I did this was because they did that. Like for every one of them, right? So like even when I was, this could probably go back to when I was in kindergarten. Because I was the Robin Hood of the bullies. Hear me out. Hold on. This is actually a public service. So like I would see the cool, I was a tomboy. And I would see like the cool kids pick on the not cool kids, or like beat up the not cool kids, or like do swirlies to the not cool kids. And my older brother is mentally handicapped, so I have a special place in my heart for the kids who struggle. I already told you that I was the kid who always had to perform all the time. So I was readily accepted into the cool kids, did not care, wasn't a big fan of them. Okay. But when they picked on those not so cool kids, I was the Robin Hood who came in and said, I'm bigger and I'm stronger because I can lift more than you. I can throw farther than you. I can run faster than you. And oh, did you miss my fist in your face? I was a Robin Hood of the bullies even in kindergarten. So when I came to the eighth step, I had a reason why every single behavior that I did was something that someone deserved, even to the point of really, it kind of made them more humble. So that took some internal work. I did get there though. So it came to my ninth step. Okay, so this is another tough spot. Like every single one of them, I've got something where Lisa showed up and wanted to create an issue with this. So, you know, when I wanted to make direct amends to such people, I was like, cool, let's get started. Let me tell you why I was like that. Was it because I wanted to make amends and I was so sorry? Does anyone actually believe that? Because that's a definite no. Okay. Was it because I wanted to do my step work because it keeps me sober? I really wish, but it was a no. Was it because I wanted to go up to people and show them how amazing I was doing so that I could get an atta girl from them? Yes, those were the top people on my amends list. That's why I was so excited to make those amends. So I did the first couple. So not only did I get a pat on my back, look at how great you're doing in your life now, I also got a pat on my back. Look at me doing my ninth step. Damn, I'm big, darn, I'm big stuff. Look at me go. And luckily, I received feedback. You know, if this is going so well for you, and you're giving yourself so many cookies about this, maybe we need to talk about your motivation for being there. And then it became so much more difficult. Became a lot harder. So the people at the bottom of my amends list, this is what we did with my amends list. That sucked. That was terrible. Included people like my mom, my dad. That is kind of difficult. Like, I admit my part in some things. And I don't get to bring up the stuff that you did to me that was in no way, shape, or form my fault. That's a difficult thing to do. But as I've heard from so many others, paves the way for a different relationship with people. I've heard that with neighbors, I've heard that with people you haven't seen in years. It's definitely true with my family. If you would have told me today that I could have even made it through my parents coming to visit me, and that I would enjoy FaceTiming with my mother and telling her about my day, I would have called you a liar. 5 years ago, I would have told you, no, I'm sure I have not been talking to them for 5 years. Today, I talk to my mom almost every single day. My dad is not at that point, but I am capable of seeing him as Dave and appreciating the things that he's taught me, appreciating the ways that he shows love, even though it's not the way I receive it. And that is why I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic, because without AA, I would have never learned how to do that. And I would have all of my life thought that my dad didn't love me. And he does. He just loves me in a different way than I receive love. And I can see that today. That's pretty freaking awesome. So we talked about my cowardice. So we just continue to take personal inventory, and we were wrong, promptly admitted it. So can we just define promptly? Can we define that? So because what's another recommendation, right? We respond, not react. Okay. So I can also tend to be overly apologetic, right? I will say something. Great example. When I was doing my sixth step with my sponsor, I listed every defect I could have ever thought of for my entire life. And the biggest, the biggest amount of work my sponsor had to do with me was say, Lisa, you don't do this. You don't do this either. I've seen you do this maybe once or twice. You don't do this defectively. This isn't a character defect. Like this is, that was the work my sponsor had to do, right? So I can't err to be that way. So with that being said, I step back and actually process, right? And also try not to be emotional about it. So instead of just saying, I'm sorry for the sake of saying I'm sorry, which is kind of like, you know, when you ask your three-year-old, like you hit your brother, say, I'm sorry. And they go, sorry. That is not an apology. So if I take a step back, I think about the situation. I think about why did I act effectively in this situation? Oftentimes, like what's one for me? If I'm feeling controlling, it's usually because I'm acting in fear and I feel unsafe. Okay. So if I need to apologize to someone about being controlling, I need to check where I felt unsafe and where I felt fearful. And that way in the future, if I start noticing those kind of coming back up in a situation, I can remind myself like, hey, you don't need to be controlling. This person is not going to harm you. And depending on the relationship, I can also let them know, right? Like I was controlling in a way that like I was micromanaging you in a way that you were absolutely capable of handling. And I'm really sorry because this is what I was experiencing at the time. And that's a mean thing. So that's with further explanation, that's what I do. So how do I seek through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand him? I do not pray. Because I don't have a deity. I do believe in a collective higher power. And I know for some, God is an ethereal deity. And I know for others, you know, he's the AA community. I know for some people it's nature, or simply just an undefined higher power that lies beyond the self. So for me, the practice of meditation is like being a satellite, and kind of emptying myself out, allowing myself to receive rather than being a projector of my self-will. Because that's what I always did, right? Let me be the marionette. Let me do all of these things. And then let me be resentful when it didn't work out because there must have been something you did wrong because you didn't do it exactly the way that I told you to because I'm the one that's running the show. So instead of projecting, if I can receive and be receptive, my life goes a lot better. Lastly, when we get to step 12, having had a spiritual awakening and carrying this message, service work's a big one for me. So I do service work at my home group because I have a home group. My sponsor, this was the suggestion by my sponsor, have a service position within your home group. Do one outside of your home group. And then another one that would be great would be like committees. So don't like have a whole bunch of long-term commitments because you might get burned out, especially because I'm a single mom that works a lot. And that has worked really great for me in a super selfish way. it does feel good to be of service, but I've learned, I've met so many people, right? Like I live in an itty bitty town with a very small percentage of women. Only one of them from my town is here today. If I had not been of service, two-thirds of the people are here today, I would not know. So I'm of service because my program has taught me to be of service. And come to find out, being of service is pretty great. I get some awesome side effects. Another side effect of that, I don't know about any of the rest of you, but when I walked in here, I had really low self-esteem. I was a part of that. There were maybe some other people in my life that were a part of that. And I was like, I have really low self-esteem. How can I raise my self-esteem? Tell me great things about me so that I can have better self-esteem. You know, Lisa, that's not how it works. We don't want external validation anymore. So if you want self-esteem, do esteemable things. That's like the simplest thing I've ever heard with such a light bulb moment. Go do stuff that I'm proud of, simply to do stuff that I'm proud of. And have that be the only motivation. And come to find out, I feel a little bit better about myself today than I did yesterday. Kind of why I'm standing here chatting with you. Even though it's very difficult, I'm introverted and kind of wanted to puke before I came in. But how do I practice them in all of my affairs? So I talked a little bit about my mom. And then on page 419 and 420 in the big book, he talks about how the hardest place to work this program has been in his own home. He says, it seems I should have learned to love my wife and family first, the newcomer to AA last. Does this ring in any bells? But it was the other way around. Eventually, I had to redo each of the 12 steps specifically with Max in mind. From the first, saying I'm powerless over alcohol and my home life is unmanageable by me, to the 12th, in which I tried to think of her as a sick Al-Anon and treat her with the love I would give a sick AA newcomer. That was transformative. So I applied that with my home life. When my mom used to call, I would answer with the expectations of mommy. I want my mom to be my mommy and all the things that come along with being a mommy. And she's imperfectly mom because she's a person. So when I started looking at her like Lynn, and I started looking at her like every one of you with the grace and empathy and patience. And when you tell me like, hey, Lisa, I really messed up, that's okay, would be my answer. Can I look at Lynn like that? And can I answer the phone and talk to Lynn? All of a sudden, my relationship has mended. And I can do that with just about anyone in my life today. I can do that with any relationship. I did that with my job. In my job, I coach, kind of tell people what to do, which hasn't been terrible. But I don't tell people what to do anymore. I give them my experience, strength, and hope. And come to find out, people kind of like being coached that way. And it's worked in every area of my life. So what that means for me now is that that very cliche of, hi, I'm so-and-so, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. The thing that made me go, okay, in the beginning. I get it today. Being an alcoholic means I get to come here. People who aren't alcoholics don't get to come here. And I know I was crazy way before I ever picked up a drink. I know I had character defects way before I ever picked up a drink. I know I was taught a way of living that was maladaptive way before I ever picked up a drink. And even though it's not perfect today, I am a much better person today than I think I ever could have ended up being if I were not an alcoholic, which means that I'm grateful for being an alcoholic. And I think I'm going to leave you with, keep coming back is not a platitude. at least not for me. This past time, I didn't just say, okay, I don't want to drink anymore, so I'm going to put it down and go to an AA meeting. I said, I don't want to drink anymore. And I came to an AA meeting and I drank. And I said, I don't want to drink anymore. And I came to an AA meeting and I worked with my sponsor and I drank. I said, I don't want to drink anymore. I got a service position. I work with my sponsor. I went to meetings. I tried to talk to people and I drank. I said, I don't want to drink anymore. And my sponsor worked the steps with me. And my sponsor didn't make me redo step one time and time again every time I drank. I kept working and I kept coming back. Until one day, I didn't drink. Thanks for letting me share. Thank you.